Okay, we'll open up the book of Genesis. And last week we went through, I'll turn this on. Not last week, but the week before. Last week we went through pumpkin pie. Thank you for the maker of that. And through all the food, so that was good. Nice to fellowship with the class next door and talk with some people we don't get to talk to all that often. But the week before we were in Genesis chapter 18. And I don't think I've ever done 33 verses ever in my life, moving through a lesson, but it was, you know, kind of one narrative. Begin just kind of reviewing chapter 18. It opens with Abraham sitting at the door of his tent near Hebron, which is kind of where he hangs out for the most part during his stay in the Promised Land. And it's the heat of the day. He sees three mysterious visitors standing nearby, and he runs and greets them and bows down before them and washes their feet, and you know, they share a meal, and kind of just a picture of that general gracious hospitality that was kind of the standard in that day. Now, if you ever come over to my house, I'm not washing feet. Sorry about that. But again, that was kind of the standard of the day there, this gracious hospitality. And it's likely, I think, the general agreement that Abraham probably knew these were maybe special visitors of some sort. You know, he'd been praying, for things to unfold, God's covenant to come to pass, and so maybe he was viewing these visitors as an answer to prayer. But there's also general agreement that he didn't know that the three visitors, it was Yahweh himself and two angels, which is what we come to understand. And it's very unlikely that he understood that right at the beginning. And again, this is Yahweh God is there. It's a Christophany, an Old Testament appearance of the pre-incarnate Christ in the form of a man. Now, there was some argument that the three visitors maybe represented the Trinity. That's a no-go. That's not really the case here. We wouldn't want to try to draw that out of this. It's Yahweh and then two angels with him. And the two angels, we don't find out for sure that they're angels till we get to chapter 19, which is what we're studying today. But they also looked like men. And remember, during the meal, they're eating together, and the visitors ask about Sarah. And then Yahweh announces that Sarah will indeed bear a son, which he'd said before back in chapter 17, I believe it was. But now he gives a specific timeline. It's going to happen within a year. Okay, so things are moving along. Isaac will be born within a year. And then remember what Sarah does when she overhears this talking in the tent. She giggles, you know, under her breath to herself. It's not blatant or anything. And, she's well past childbearing years, and this would be too difficult. And so she laughs. And then what does the visitor do? Yahweh, why'd your wife laugh? And she's listening. She's going, I didn't laugh. But she did. But, you know, God gently confronts her. But she's frightened, you know, after she's figuring out what's going on here. This is God talking. She expressed doubt, which she shouldn't have done. Then after the meal in verse 6, the last half of chapter 18, the two angels continue their visitor. The two angels that were visiting continue their trip to Sodom. And that's where we're going to pick up today in chapter 19. But Yahweh sticks back with Abraham and talks about the issue of justice and judgment and intercession is kind of the what we points that were covered in that last half of chapter 18. So in verse 21 of chapter 18, Yahweh determines to inform Abraham of his intention to judge wicked Sodom because of Abraham's special covenantal relationship with him. There's kind of this conversation. Yahweh says, why should I tell Abraham what I'm going to do? You know, the special relationship that I have with him. He's going to be a great nation. He's going to teach his descendants righteousness. So I'm going to share this with him. Again, this is all unfolding for our benefit. This is why Abraham is privy to the information that he's going to reveal about the coming destruction of Sodom. And of course, Sodom is of great special interest to Abraham because his nephew Lot and his family live in Sodom. So again, God uses this gracious conversation with Abraham to convey to us some key truths regarding divine justice. Remember, kind of those key points where God just doesn't judge arbitrarily. He's aware of all the facts. He knows what's going on. Okay, so when he judges, it's righteous judgment. And he doesn't, God doesn't treat the righteous the same as the wicked. Okay, and that's another key piece in this discussion between Yahweh and Abraham. So Abraham approaches God, you know, with bold humility, and he asks God, would you destroy the righteous with the wicked? You know, he appeals to God's justice, and will you still destroy Sodom if there's 50 righteous people in there? And God says, no, I won't. And then Abraham kind of goes into this negotiation mode. Would you do it for 40, 30, 20, 10? And God is, no, I won't destroy it if there's 10 righteous people there. Well, Sodom's going to get destroyed. That means there weren't 10 righteous people in all of Sodom. So again, God agrees to spare the cities for the sake of the number of, you know, if 10 righteous people are in that city. So here also, too, we see Abraham's compassion and concern for the lost. It extends beyond just Lot, you know, to if there's 50 people there, will you destroy it? No, I won't. Okay, that's God's answer. So that chapter ends with Yahweh departing from Abraham and Abraham returning home. And that sets the stage, really, for chapter 19, where we have the application of divine justice, kind of the outline up there on the board. Excuse me. So let's pick up in chapter 19. Then the two angels, so this is the first time that we find out that those two visitors that were with Yahweh are actually angels. Then the two angels came to Sodom in the evening as Lot was sitting by the gate of Sodom. So they're clearly identified as angels. The exact location of Sodom and Gomorrah is uncertain. Okay, we've talked about that before. Most likely they were at the bottom of what we would currently call the Dead Sea. They may even be covered by the Dead Sea now. There's no archaeological certainty as to where they were, but it would be probably 40-plus miles from Hebron, where Abraham is centered, down to Sodom. And Lot is sitting by the gate, okay? And sitting by the gate was a kind of a big deal back in this day and age, because that's where a lot of civic activities happened, where business was conducted and prominent citizens conducted community affairs. So there's a implies here, you know, that Lot sitting by the gate implies that he was kind of had become an integrated citizen, or maybe a citizen of note in Sodom. So Lot goes, I thought this was kind of interesting, that in chapter 13, if you look at chapter 13 and then chapter 14, Lot goes from settling near Sodom after him and Abraham separate, to becoming an important, from settling near Sodom to living in Sodom, and now an important member of the city. So again, he's just kind of gotten acclimated into this wicked city. And maybe, you know, his rise to prominence was helped by his uncle's deliverance of that city back in chapter 14 in the Battle of the Kings. You know, it's Abraham that kind of does in the kings that attacked. And so Sodom, the king of Sodom, is delivered because of Abraham's action. Oh, this is Abraham's nephew. We better put him in a position of prominence. And so sadly, as we're going to see as we walk through the account in chapter 19, though, Lot's, he's a righteous man. He's a saved man. We know that from the New Testament. But he doesn't have any discernible impact on wicked Sodom. Okay, so he lives in Sodom, but no discernible positive impact. So back in verse 1, so Lot saw them and rose to meet them and bowed down with his face to the ground. And he said, now behold, my lords, please turn aside into your servant's house and spend the night and wash your feet. Then you may rise early and go on your way. They said, however, no, but we shall spend the night in the square. Yet he pressed them strongly, so they turned aside to him and entered his house, and he made a feast for them and baked unleavened bread, and they ate. So again, just that same gracious hospitality that we saw with Abraham back in chapter 18 with the three visitors. And, you know, he treats them the same way. He bows in humility and respect and addresses them, you know, very honorably. And they said, no, we're not going to stay. But we see Lot there urging them, you know, kind of pressing them to stay because he's aware of the lurking dangers in Sodom after dark. Lot knows where he lives. He knows what happens. and he knows that they would be in great danger if they spent the night outside. So verse 4. Before they lay down, so they're in Lot's house now. Before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, surrounded the house from young to old, all the people from every quarter. And they called to Lot and said to him, "Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may know them." And that word "know" means to know intimately. With New American Standard, it says have relations. So it's clear what's going on here. I think NIV says have sex with them. So there's no debate as to what's going on here. It's very clear what they're wanting to do. But Lot, verse 6, "But Lot went out to them at the doorway and shut the door behind him. And he said, 'Please, my brothers, do not act wickedly.'" So the news of these visiting strangers spreads fast through the town. It attracts a large crowd of men from throughout the city, you know, of every age group, from every, you know, sector of the city, with the goal of this, you know, homosexual assault and rape. And this is the first reference to homosexuality in the Bible. And again, it's a practice, regardless of what the culture says today, it's a practice that's widely condemned in both the Old Testament and the New Testament in multiple places. Okay, there's no question but that it is a sin. And what these men are doing here is, you know, just a vivid picture of the incredible wickedness and widespread depravity of the Sodomites. And again, you know, Sodom and Gomorrah become proverbial for wickedness. And again, that's, we find that numerous references in both the New and Old Testament, where Sodom and Gomorrah are examples of wickedness and divine judgment on sin. Verse 8, "Now behold, I have two daughters." I almost don't like reading this part. "Now behold, I have two daughters who have not known a man." So again, that same word "known" that we saw back in verse 5. They're virgins. "Have not known a man. Please let me bring them out to you and do to them what is good in your eyes. Only do nothing to these men, inasmuch as they have come under my shelter, have come under the shelter of my roof." But they said, "Step aside." Furthermore, they said, "This one came to sojourn, and already he is persistently acting like a judge. Now we will treat you more wickedly than them." So they pressed hard against Lot and stepped up to break the door. So again, in this, you know, desperate and shocking effort to protect his guests, he offers to turn his two virgin daughters over to these sexual predators. And I mean, it's very hard for us to relate to this in any way, shape, or form. A couple of the commentators noted, you know, it's explained by the hospitality culture that existed at that day. When somebody comes under your roof, they're under your protection. They're like part of your family. So that helps to understand it a little bit more, but in no way justifies what Lot was proposing here. And it's an example of how Lot, the believer, was in Sodom but had no impact on that city. But that city, that culture, had a big impact on him. Okay, he was in grievous sin for what he was doing here. And he probably saw it as the lesser of two evils. It's not like he was happy to give away his daughters, but he just elevated the protection of these visitors above his own family. So I was reading this and I was thinking, boy, an assault rifle would have come in real handy in that day. Excuse me. So, and actually, there's something far better waiting for these men in Sodom, and that's divine judgment, because that's where this story is going to end. So let's turn over real quick. I thought this was a good verse to plug in, but let's go over to 2 Peter chapter 4. I go to a harder book to find because that way I know I can get a drink. Sneak in a drink. Well, what's that?
There's no four chapters.
2 Peter chapter 2, sorry. That gives me even longer to take a drink. 2 Peter chapter 2. And let's go down to verse 4. And the context here is the rise of false prophets and dealing with them. And down in verse 4, "For if God did not spare angels who sinned, but cast them into the pit and delivered them to chains of darkness, being kept for judgment. Again, some would say that ties back to Genesis 6, where we have the sons of God and the daughters of men intermarrying. Verse 5, and did not spare the ancient world, but preserved Noah, a preacher of righteousness, with seven others when he brought a flood upon the world of the ungodly. And if he condemned the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah to destruction by reducing them to ashes, having made them an example to those who would live ungodly lives thereafter, and if he rescued righteous Lot, oppressed by the sensual conduct of unprincipled men, I like verse 8, for by what he saw and heard, this is talking about Lot, that righteous man, he was saved, while living among them, felt his righteous soul tormented day after day by their lawless deeds. So we get kind of a sense of Lot's existence in Sodom, you know, 2,000 years before this was written. He was tormented by what he saw. I mean, he struggled with how things unfolded there, but yet he was still impacted by that godless culture. Let's go back to Genesis chapter 19. So, and also too, this made me think of, similar situation in Judges 19, where we have the wicked men of Gibeah, the very close parallel here with what happens in the town of Gibeah and the tribe of Benjamin. There's a traveling Levite, and he comes to the city and is offered lodging by an elderly man. I guess we all fit that now, so. But he's offered shelter by an elderly man, and the wicked townsmen in Gibeah surround this elderly man's house, and they demand to sexually assault this traveling Levite. So very similar thing going on here. And then to protect his guest, what does the elderly man do? He offers his virgin daughter, you know, but the Levite says, no, let me send out my concubine instead. So the elderly man doesn't have to send out his daughter to satisfy these unnatural lusts. But traveling Levite sends out his concubine, and she's abused all night. Remember, in the morning, she's dead. And so the Levite takes her body, chops it into 12 pieces, mails it out to all the tribes. And the end result is it ignites a rebellion, a civil war against the tribe of Benjamin because of the wickedness of the Gibeonites. So kind of a very similar picture here as far as the cultural setting of that day and what's happening. You think about, I mean, America's bad, but I don't think that this happens in very many places. So, okay, but in verse 9, back in chapter Genesis 19, verse 9, Lot's pleas fall on deaf ears and hardened hearts. The crowd threatens to harm him as well as the visitors. And then they accuse him of acting superior. You know, you're an outsider, you're just a sojourner. So this is kind of how they're looking at him, even though he's been a resident of Sodom for some time now. But again, kind of that idea, he's not fitting in perfectly well. So they're accusing him of being a judge, despite the fact that he's an outsider. So he hasn't fit in well necessarily. But again, he has no respect from these wicked people. Okay, verse 10. But the men reached out their hands, again, these are the angels. The men reached out their hands and brought Lot into the house with them and shut the door. And they struck the men who were at the doorway of the house with blindness, from small to great, so that they wearied themselves trying to find the door. So this is dramatic action. And you can imagine Lot, he had no idea these were angels at the time. And all of a sudden, you know, he's outside and the crowd's coming to assault him so they can get into the house. And the angels reach out and pull him in, and then they strike the whole crowd with blindness. This particular word for blindness is only used one other time. It's in 2 Kings chapter 6, verse 18, in response to Elisha, to a prayer by Elisha. But I kind of like what Ryrie said on this particular word. It's a loss of distortion of vision resulting in mental confusion and bewilderment. So they're just like, they're stumbling around, fumbling around. But look what's driving them. They exhaust themselves trying to get to that door and get in that house. You know, they're exhausted by their pursuit of their sin. And that's pretty ironic that the men, angels, that Lot was working to protect, end up protecting him instead. So, and then if Lot probably didn't know that these were angels before. He knows it now. These are special people. Look what they just did to this crowd of people. So verse 12. Then the two men said to Lot, "Whom else have you here? A son-in-law and your sons and your daughters and everyone you have in the city, bring them out of this place. For we are about to destroy this place because their outcry has become great before Yahweh. So Yahweh has sent us to destroy it." So angel's instruction and warning is get your family together and get out and get out now because judgment and destruction is coming. You know, the actions of the city are crying out for justice, and it's going to come raining down quite literally here pretty soon. Verse 14, and Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-law. So the only other family that we know that he has for sure were these two sons-in-law. The angels weren't necessarily identifying every family member he had in that town. They were just saying, whoever you got here, go out and get them. Sons, daughters, sons-in-law, get them all. And he goes and talks to his sons-in-law. Sons, is it son-in-laws? No, sons-in-law. Okay. And he went out and spoke to his sons-in-law who were to marry his daughters in verse 14 and said, get up, get out of this place, for Yahweh will destroy the city. So they got up and ran and listened to their father and, you know, future father-in-law with great respect. And nope, that's not what happened. But he appeared to his sons-in-law to be jesting. So they ignore him. They don't get up. They don't go. They're not paying any attention to him. So we kind of see that moral decay in this city, excuse me, has impacted even those close to Lot. We're going to see not only has it impacted these future sons-in-law, but it impacts his wife and it impacts his daughters too. We'll see as we continue to move on through the chapter. So verse 15. Now at the breaking of dawn, the angels urged Lot, saying, get up, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, lest you be swept away in the punishment of this city. But he hesitated. So the men seized his hand and the hand of his wife and the hands of his two daughters, for the compassion of Yahweh was upon him. And they brought him out and put him outside the city. So again, the angels, you know, get your family that's here, your wife, your two daughters, and get out without delay. That word urge to push or press. But what does Lot do? He hesitates. It's also translated lingered. You get the idea that maybe he was conflicted about abandoning his home. Can't we just go to the basement? You know, let's hide out, find a safe place in the house. And, you know, he maybe underestimated the danger that was going to come, that everything was going to be just leveled and wiped out completely. But maybe the idea of abandoning his home and his wealth and his social standing and his future family, you know, that slowed him down apparently, and he hesitated. He lingered, kind of like you can tell Jesse I use some alliteration, lingering Lot. I don't do that very often. But now when I think a lot, that word lingered always kind of, you know, should have got out of there quick. But then in an act of divine mercy, the angels physically and forcefully grab their hands and escort them out of the city and out of danger. That word compassion in verse 9 comes from the word despair, and it's typically translated mercy. Okay, I think ESV and New King James translates this being merciful. So this was a demonstration of mercy when these angels take these people and get them out of the city before the devastation occurs. So God's mercy overcame lingering Lot's procrastination. So verse 17. Now it happened as they brought them outside, one said, escape for your life. Do not look behind you and do not stay anywhere in the valley. Escape. That word escape is used 5 times in this section here. So that's the emphasis. Get out of here. Escape. Escape to the mountains in verse 17, lest you be swept away. But Lot said, oh, no, my lords. Now behold, your servant has found favor in your sight, and you have magnified your loving kindness, which you have shown me by preserving my life. But I cannot escape to the mountains, lest calamity overtake me and I die. Now behold, this town is near enough to flee to, and it is small. Please let me escape there. Is it not small, that my life may be preserved? So again, we have another hesitation here. Lot, and probably the general agreement that his concern here is, I can't get away to the mountains and climb the mountains. I'm too old for that. So let's go someplace closer, a small, out of the way place. You know, he presents an alternative plan. You know, he begs to take refuge in a small neighboring town. Verse 18, and that town is, after this occurs, it's called Zoar. And we've run into Zoar before. We saw that back in chapter 13, verse 10, and chapter 14, verse 2 and 8. But that word Zoar comes from the word that means insignificant. So that's where it got its name from. It's where Lot wanted to go. So he didn't have to apparently flee all the way to the mountains and climb the mountains for safety. But that, if back in chapter 14, we also saw that this town had been known originally. It was originally named Bela. So Bela and Zoar are the same place. But so he wants to not go quite so far. And apparently they honor his request and agree to spare this town. But it's just about hurry. You need to get there. That's, we'll accept your plan to go to Zoar instead of to the mountains. Okay, verse 23. The sun had risen over the earth when Lot came to Zoar, and Yahweh rained on Sodom and Gomorrah brimstone and fire from Yahweh out of heaven. And he overthrew those cities and all the valley and all the inhabitants of the cities and what grew on the ground. Then his wife looked behind him, then his wife from behind him looked back, and she became a pillar of salt. So, you know, as soon as Lot and his family reach safety, the destruction begins. And that word brimstone, also translated sulfur, NIV translates this as burning sulfur. The idea is all this hot, molten stuff comes raining down. And again, brimstone in particular is a common picture of God's judgment. And in a number of references in the New and Old Testament. It's interesting that in Revelation chapter 19, 20, and 21, brimstone is a description of hell itself. So this is, you know, the fire and heat and stuff that accompanies this. The question arises, was this providential or was this miraculous? You know, and the general agreement is this couldn't have been a volcano because they weren't really in that area. So, because some people would say a volcano could really cover this pretty well. Some say maybe lightning and the lightning with, you know, there's an earthquake and intense lightning and the lightning ignited. Remember from back in Genesis chapter 14 in the Battle of the Kings, there were tar pits all over this area. So, you know, petroleum gas being released and lightning igniting it. And it's kind of a cool picture to think about, but I think probably it's best to come down. This was supernatural. Okay, God doesn't need an earthquake. He doesn't need a volcano. He doesn't need lightning. Yeah, maybe he uses them providentially, but it's, you know, probably he just went whoosh, you know, he created it in his hands and rained it down on Sodom and Gomorrah. But again, clear evidence here is as Sodom is destroyed, there's not even 10 righteous people in that city, which we saw back in chapter 18, verse 32. And then verse 26, you know, the tragedy of Lot's wife. I mean, she looks back and she becomes a pillar of salt. She disobeyed the angel's explicit and clear warning. Do not look back. Now, these are angels. Look what they did. They did all, made all these people blind. I'd be listening to everything they said very carefully, I would hope to think, but she looks back. And the general agreement that this is really just a picture of her inability to, you know, to lead the life she left behind. She was still longing for some things. You know, everything's gone now. And so she looks back. I think it was Ryrie said her heart was still in Sodom. Okay, she was still had that connection. And the end result is judgment. She becomes a pillar of salt. Again, there's debate, you know, whether she was just covered with molten stuff falling from the sky and encased in it, or whether, you know, her chemical nature was changed and she became chemical salt. We don't really know. There are some salt rock formations at the southern end of the Dead Sea now that you can go see, and some of them are about human size, and some people try to identify, I think this one, you know, was Lot's wife, or this one. It's like, you know, that's an exercise in futility. I don't think we can really do that. But the key is that Lot's wife was judged, and she became a pillar of salt. And whatever that pillar of salt was, I think it's something we don't want. I don't want to be a pillar of salt. So then Lot's wife, again, becomes a picture of those looking back to the old way of life. You know, there's judgment for that. That's not a good thing. That's not what we're to do. Okay, verse 27. Now Abraham, so now the scene shifts back to the area of Hebron where Abraham is, so about 40, 50 miles away or so. So Abraham arose early in the morning and went to the place where he had stood before Yahweh. And he looked down towards Sodom and Gomorrah. So he was up high. Hebron would be kind of a high vantage point. Can look in 40, 50 miles away. He could see the destruction that was going on. And I did a little bit of research, and the claim is that you should be able to see like a burning, you know, a big burning event like a fire from about 60, 70 miles from a high vantage point. So it would be easy for him to be able to look down and see what was going on in the valley in the area of Sodom and Gomorrah. And verse 28, and behold, he saw the smoke of the land that went up like the smoke of a furnace. So again, Abraham sees what's going on and the smoldering ruins of the cities. And these were cities that he had previously delivered back in chapter 14. And now all of a sudden, they're up in fire. You know, was he disappointed at what occurred? Doesn't really say. But he would be comforted by the knowledge that God's judgment is just and righteous. That's a discussion that he had with the Lord back in chapter 18. So, you know, he's like, there must not have been 10 righteous in that city. And then verse 29, thus it happened when God destroyed the cities of the valley that God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow when he overthrew the cities in which Lot lived. So again, God worked through Abraham to deliver righteous Lot. We saw Lot was a believer and his two daughters. Abraham's intercession from chapter 18 had been answered. Okay, and Genesis, we don't ever find out if Abraham knew that Lot was delivered. Okay, I would assume probably yes, but we don't ever know for sure. And I thought it was an interesting point that, you know, God answers prayers. When we pray for someone or pray for people, lots of times we have no idea how that might come out. So it's good to pray for people, even though, like Abraham, we may not ever know the result of our intercession. But it's something that God does use. God used Abraham's intercession here to deliver Lot out of this disaster. Excuse me. So that brings us to the end of the chapter. I had just a couple of questions that have come up over the last 2, 3, 4 weeks that I thought I'd just address real quick. And one of them, what was the population of Sodom? Somebody had asked that, and generally speaking, the agreement is it was probably 1 to 5,000, and there's a couple of reasons for that. And John Walton, an Old Testament scholar who I read, said 1,000 to 3,000, but it was big enough to have gates in verse 1, so it wasn't like a hamlet of 50 people. I mean, it was bigger than that. And then the flow of the narrative seems to indicate, you know, there were a lot of men who surrounded that house. They were from every quarter of the city, young and old. So it indicates that there were probably a number of people there. And then archaeological evidence from that time period of other cities seemed to indicate that it was probably somewhere between 1 and 5,000. So then the other question, which was really good, believers often suffer along with unbelievers in natural disasters and other types of suffering. So what's kind of going on here with God delivering, you know, Sodom, even if there was 10 righteous people in there? But lots of times the righteous do suffer. And Genesis 18 in particular, there's a question about Genesis 18, is about judgment and the effectiveness of intercession, not suffering in general. Because lots of times believers, you know, if there's an earthquake in Lincoln, Nebraska, guess what? Believers and unbelievers. I doubt that it needs, you know, a big, massive earthquake all over. I doubt that all of our individual houses and our church and, you know, everything we frequent would be delivered. Because, you know, lots of times believers do suffer right along with unbelievers in natural disasters and all those things. But the key there is that, again, that Genesis 18 is about judgment, not suffering in general. And so again, in the sin-cursed world, the righteous and the unrighteous suffer together, but the difference is in the purpose and outcome of the suffering. Because for the unbeliever, for the wicked and unrepentant, you know, the suffering creates what? Chaos and despair and ultimately through death, eternal torment in hell. Okay, that's suffering in the realm of the unbelievers. But for us, what does it do? Okay, I mean, the purpose of, there's a specific purpose for the suffering of the unbeliever. It's chastening. It's a means of spiritual development and growth. I was just talking with somebody earlier. You know, the times when we have smooth going in this life, it's the time to prepare for the trials that are going to come, because trials will come. And like James says, you know, James chapter 1, verse 2 and following, consider it all joy, my brothers, when you encounter various trials. I have a hard time with that sometimes. It's easy when I'm not going through the trial. But consider it all joy, my brothers, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith brings about perseverance, and let perseverance have its perfect work, so that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. So how does God make us lack in nothing? He subjects us to trials. That's just the way it is. I think I've said that before. I wish it was like eating cookies was his means of sanctification, but it's trials. It's how he develops us into the people he wants us to be. So again, Genesis chapter 18, nothing to do with that kind of suffering. It has to do with judgment. Romans chapter 8, verse 18, the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that is to be revealed to us. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 17, for our momentary light affliction is working out for us an eternal weight of glory far beyond all comparison. So again, even the ultimate end of suffering, death, is basically for what, you know, what for us is the doorway, entrance into heaven and into the very presence of God. So I'll go ahead and stop there. We have a couple of minutes left if anybody has any observations or questions, except for Gus. So. Does anybody have any thoughts or questions on anything? Okay, let's go ahead and close with prayer. Dear Father, again, we want to just praise you and thank you so much for this time together and just the encouragement it is to gather as like-minded believers and to look into your word. We just thank you and praise you so much for the Holy Spirit who helps us to understand things that are sometimes very difficult to understand. And just thank you for the truths we've learned out of Genesis 18 and 19. We just pray, Father, again, that you'd help us to apply the truths and principles that you teach us here in your word. We just ask, Father, that we'd be faithful, found faithful in everything we do, that we'd manifest your character to those around us, that the things we do and the studying we do in your word would be like a sweet aroma to you, well-pleasing in your sight. We just pray, Father, for the sermon to follow and for Pastor Jesse as he works through his education goals that will ultimately benefit us and be pleasing to you. We just thank you for your love. In Jesus' name, amen.